fact, Joe and I first bonded over being Braves fans in the Midwest, in the world of the Cubs and the Cincinnati Reds and whatever team you might be rooting for. Good morning. It's great to be with y'all. I have been looking forward to this. When I came to my current post with Indiana Ministries back in 2008, Catalyst was the first church that was planted during the time that I've been here. And so Chris and I connected early. We've stayed friends. We stay in contact with each other. Love the job that Catalyst has done over the years. And as a result, my wife and I are usually popping for worship several times a year to kind of keep tabs on what's going on. And when Pastor Rollin came to be your pastor, that was like really cool because he and I date back to college. In fact, the first time I remember meeting him was on the intramural football field at Anderson University, where the team I was a wide receiver for, he was a quarterback for the opposite team, and we were playing for the intramural championships. And that wasn't the first time we played against each other for the intramural championships. So usually when we see each other, we tackle or we slap or we hit or we foul, you know, something sports related. In that way. But so excited that he's your pastor. And also Pastor Carl and Valerie, been friends with them since the college years. In fact, if I look at my closest friends in ministry, Rollin and Carl are going to be two of those who pretty much know all. They know all the dirt. They know all the downside. They've seen me at my worst. And I've seen them at their worst too. So I can blackmail them equally. As a result, there's a code of silence that we have. But a chance to be with y'all today and to share while Pastor Rollin and Pastor Carl both are gone for a little bit of a break. It's really fun. And I am pumped about what's happening at Catalyst with your new site. I really am. Haven't had a chance to go on site and walk through and see it. Rollin's verbally described it to me. But really excited about the present and the future of Catalyst and the impact that you're all having. This morning I want to talk with you about prayer. I know it's church, you talk about Jesus or prayer, right? But I specifically want to talk to you about not giving up. When you pray about something again and again and again, and yet there seems to be no action on God's part in answering that prayer. You know, several years ago, there was a theologically challenged movie called Bruce Almighty. And in the movie, Bruce was given the powers of God for a season of time to kind of see what it was like. And if you saw the movie, you might remember a scene where he's getting ready to go to bed, and instead he heads for the computer, and he wants to check the prayers that he's been receiving that day, and he's going to respond to them before going to bed. The only problem is, for every one he responds to, there's about 500,000 more prayers that come in. And so he's reading each one of them very diligently, and he lacked God's power to multitask in conversations with people, and he could only do one prayer request at a time. And it wasn't long before there were millions of prayer requests that had built up, and even billions. The entire night had passed. He's fallen asleep at the computer, and prayer requests continue to pile one on top of the other. So Bruce hits select all, types in yes, and hits send. And he responds to every single prayer request with the affirmative, yes. If you remember the next scene, the entire world is in chaos. There's craziness everywhere. And Bruce realizes that answering yes to everybody's prayer request may not have been the wisest thing to do. Do you ever wish God would answer all of your prayer requests with a blanket yes? I'll be honest, I do. I wish every time I prayed, God would just say in advance, "Hey, Doug, the answer's yes. Now, go ahead and pray." I mean, don't we want our prayers to shape God's activity in the world today? Don't we want to give God cues about what's going on around us and what He needs to do? You know, there are times I pray some really good prayers, and I give God step-by-step directions of what He should do. And it's like He's just not paying attention. You know, this prayer thing, I'll be honest, after pastoring for about 40 years, I still don't understand it. I don't know when God's going to say yes, when God's going to say no, and when God's just going to seem to go silent and not give me any answer at all, which I usually interpret as wait, or, Doug, that really isn't a very good idea after all. But I mean, the reason we pray, it is to shape God's perspective, His understanding, and to try to help Him figure out, as if He needs help, what He should do in a given situation. In Luke chapter 11, Jesus is giving us instruction about prayer. In fact, the whole chapter is about prayer. But Luke 11 includes the Lord's Prayer, which really it's our prayer. I mean, He said, when you pray, pray like this. So He's giving us what we should be praying. And you remember there's that phrase in there, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And yet we still pray and we want to influence God's will in any way we can. Well, in this particular chapter, there is a parable that Jesus tells about prayer. It's one of my favorite parables. It's Luke chapter 11. It's a short parable. It's only verses 5 through 8. I'm reading from the New International Version. Suppose one of you has a friend, and he goes to him at midnight and says, friend, lend me 3 loaves of bread, because a friend of mine on a journey has come to me, and I have nothing to set before him. Then the one inside answers, don't bother me. The door is already locked, and the children are in bed with me. I can't get up and give you anything. I tell you, though he will not get up and give man bread because he is his friend, yet because of the man's persistence, he will get up and give him as much as he needs. Parables like this were one of the ways Jesus frequently taught people about life and God. You know, we don't speak in parables much these days. In fact, just a quick show of hands, how many of you have told a parable to someone this last week as a learning opportunity for them? I mean, look around the room. No hands. I haven't even used a parable, and I'm a pastor, and, you know, we're supposed to talk Bible talk all the time, but I haven't told a parable in I don't know how long. You know, parables were a part of the everyday world Jesus lived in. They were a common teaching tool. People more readily understood parables then than they do now. So let's take a few moments and unpack this particular parable so we can find out what Jesus is actually saying. The context for this parable is a late-night traveler who stops by a friend's house because he needs something to eat on his journey. Now, he's traveling at night, probably not because he was a night owl, probably not because the kids would sleep better at night and the journey would be more peaceful. But if you remember back in Jesus' world, it was a desert. And so the daytime would get extremely hot. There were not air-conditioned planes, trains, and automobiles. People traveled by foot, by donkey, or by horseback. Maybe even throw a few camels in here or there. So traveling at day was difficult. Traveling at night was a lot more pleasant. Now, if you and I were traveling, even if we were traveling all night and we got hungry, we could always pull at the drive end of a 24/7 White Castle and have a few gut bombers. But in Jesus' day, they did not have fine gourmet dining establishments like White Castles. Instead, if people wanted something to eat, once they ate the food they carried with them on a journey, which would not be a significant amount, they would have to stop at someone's house en route and ask them for food. And so people plotted their trips based on where they had friends living. And they had prearranged in their own mind that they couldn't text ahead to let them know, but in their own mind they would prearrange, I'll stop here and see so-and-so, here and see so-and-so, here and see so-and-so, and I can get to the journey, get where I'm going. So people had to depend on the generosity of others in order to get to their destination. So this late night traveler stops by a friend's house about midnight, and he asks for some food. But the host was totally caught off guard. Nothing. Even the fridge was empty. Not a Twinkie or a Hostess Snowball. Not even any Ritz crackers. Absolutely nothing. But you see, he had a responsibility, and hear that word clearly, he had a responsibility to be hospitable to the late night traveler and provide him with something to eat. So the host, having been caught by surprise and totally unprepared, needed to provide some kind of food for his friend. You see, hospitality was highly valued in Jesus' day. Did you know that you would get a lousy reputation in your neighborhood if you were not hospitable to other people? Because it was a world without many restaurants or hotels, people depended on others' generosity literally to survive a trip. Without the generosity of others, you would either die of starvation or you could die of lack of water. So people had to be hospitable to make the world work. When someone stopped by your house, you had an obligation to help the person. Well, the host in our story took the responsibility of hospitality so seriously that he went next door to get some assistance from his neighbor. And normally borrowing some bread from your neighbor would not have been a big deal. But the story says it was around midnight. Midnight. Some of you call that early. You're night owls. You're up until 1 or 2 o'clock. Interesting things. Night owls tend to marry early birds. So if you're married, the chances are your mate is the opposite of you in terms of what they think of bedtime. In Jesus' day, there were no electric lights, so you couldn't make midnight look like daytime. Instead, midnight looked like midnight. It was pitch black unless there was a moon. It was expensive to operate an oil lamp. So most people went to bed right after sunset, and they would get up with sunrise. So by midnight, most people would have been asleep for 4-5 hours. You know, there's a reason why we call it midnight. For the ancient world, it was literally the middle of the night. But the host got up his courage. He knew he would wake them up by asking for anything to serve his friend, because he had been woken up by the friend who came to the door. But he heads over next door and he walks up on the porch and he's greeted by a closed door. Now that's what we would expect. We keep our doors closed. In fact, most of us probably keep our doors closed and locked. But in the ancient world, doors were left open all day. In fact, if you walked to your neighbor's or even a stranger's house in the middle of the day in the ancient world, the door would have been standing wide open. And if you knocked, they would have said, "Come on in, the door's open." And it literally was. An open door signified, "You're welcome. Come on inside." It was an invitation. Any idea what a closed door signified? Do not disturb. Don't knock. Don't try to come in. Don't even think about it. But the host was in a quandary. He had to knock on the door and wake him up. And by the way, knock was not the nice, polite thing. It was more, because it was a thick door. And you had to bang on it with your fist to make enough noise for anybody inside to hear it. But he was so concerned to be hospitable to his friend who was traveling, he disregarded the lateness of the hour. He banged on the door. And then in the story, the response was, "Leave us alone. We're already in bed. It's the middle of the night, you idiot." I kind of added that part. Jesus didn't really say it. "It's the middle of the night, you idiot. Go back to your house and go to bed." And then they get into a conversation and they're going back and forth. He's saying, "But wait a minute. A guy has stopped by and needs some food. You know, the neighbors will talk about me if I don't do something." "We're already talking about you. You're banging on our door at midnight." And there seems to have been this lengthy interaction between the two of them. But the later part of verse 8, Jesus says this, "Yet because of the man, the host's, persistence, the guy in bed will eventually get up and give him as much as he needs, if for no other reason, just to get rid of him so he can go back to sleep." You know, that verse seems to imply that the host kept banging on the door until the guy did get up out of desperation, get him some food, and bring it to him. You know, I used to interpret this parable to say, in order to get God to answer yes to your requests, you have to bug the living daylights out of him. You have to pester him. You have to pray long, often, and loud. And eventually, God will get so tired of you pestering him that he will give you a yes to your prayer request. That's actually what I thought the parable was trying to teach us. But that's not the message. You see, the parable is not depicting God as being stingy with a yes. It's not describing a God who is reluctant to help us when we pray. It's not saying you've got to wear out his patience first, and then and only then will he say yes to your request. Actually, the English translation of this parable is a little misleading. Here's what Jesus is really saying. If you go to a friend at midnight and ask for food because somebody traveling is passing through town and you don't have anything to give them, would you expect them to grant your request or deny it because they're already in bed? Of course, you'd expect them to grant the request. I mean, even if you had a bad neighbor and you had to pound and pound and pound on the door to persistently become a problem, at least then they would help, but you wouldn't expect that from your neighbor, would you? So here's really the teaching. If an imperfect neighbor like you have would get up in the middle of the night to give you something because you needed it, how much more do you think a perfect, loving God, your heavenly Father, would respond to your needs when you pray? You know, there have been times in my life when I prayed and prayed and prayed about something I thought was just super huge and important. And it's like God didn't listen at all. Sometimes they have to do with somebody who's sick and needs to be healed. Like Christy. I met Christy and Bill when I was in seminary. Bill was a chaplain in Indianapolis. They attended the church that I pastored. When she was in her 30s, she was diagnosed with breast cancer. And so we prayed. They had two school-age kids. They needed their mom. We prayed and we prayed and we prayed, and it metastasized. It spread through her body. And after about a year, it metastasized to the brain. And we prayed even more diligently, and yet Christy passed, leaving behind a husband in his 30s to raise two young school-age boys. I never understood, God, why didn't you heal her? I mean, God, this is a no-brainer. Come on. There was Chad. Chad diagnosed with leukemia at 15. 2 years later, after all kind of hospital stays and treatments, 17 years old, senior in high school, Chad dies of leukemia. It's like, God, this is another no-brainer. Aren't you listening? Aren't you paying attention? There's people that I know, very close to me, that I love dearly, and they seem to have no interest in God whatsoever. And I pray and I pray for years. I pray that God would send His Spirit and woo them into a friendship with Himself, lead them to the point of committing their lives to Him. And it's like decades have gone by, and it's like nothing's happening. I see no indication that God's paying any attention to that prayer whatsoever. There's something about the way that our world was created, the spiritual dynamics whereby our world operates, that I don't understand. I mean, I could read through the Bible cover to cover 50 times in 1 year, and I don't think I would ever understand really the intricate spiritual dynamics whereby our world operates. And so when I think something's a no-brainer for God to respond to, and He doesn't, I don't understand why. And sometimes I don't know what to do with that. Sometimes I get really frustrated and irritated, even angry at God, because it's like He's not paying attention. And yet I see scriptures like this and other scriptures that talk about how God answers prayer, how God responds to our needs. But it just seems like there are times when God is not to be found. What do I do with that? And you know what I've concluded? I mean, it's not some profound theological reality that you probably need to write down. I think you can remember it. What I've concluded is we don't pray to get God to say yes. In other words, the big question isn't, when I pray and I pray and I pray, will God say yes? The really huge question is, if you pray, 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 and pray, and God doesn't grant your request, what do you do? Do you quit praying about it? Do you get angry at Him? Angry to the point that you stop trusting Him? Do you find yourself doubting that He is really a good, good Father? Do you reach a point where you just kind of brush Him away and you go your own way and you walk away from Him? You know, I think the answer to what we do depends on how we see God. If we see God as someone like the neighbor in the story who's stingy with yes, if we see God and we wonder if He really cares about us and He really loves us, if we see God as someone who's reluctant to respond to our prayers, then I'm guessing we may very well walk away from Him at some point. But if you see God as loving you dearly, being concerned about the exact same things that you're concerned about, if you believe that God is working upstream to respond to your request, and the answer simply hasn't gotten downstream to where you are yet, then you're likely to keep praying. 2005, Cindy and I left a church that I'd been pastoring for 26 years. And I'm from the South, so we moved to Florida. Lived there for about 3 years, and I was working with the Florida State Ministry, which is the Florida equivalent of Indiana Ministries. And when we moved there, after we sold our house in Indiana, we bought a villa. I think that's a fancy Florida word for condo. And these villas were kind of clumped with four side by side and then a little green space in between and then four more that shared common walls. So we had neighbors on both sides of us. On one side was Ron, on the other side was Deb. Ron was the world's best neighbor. I'll put him up against anybody. Ron is such a good neighbor, when we moved back to Indiana, I wanted to bring Ron with us and have him move in next door. Ron had every tool at Lowe's. And though he was an attorney, his brother was a general contractor, and he grew up in a family of builders. Ron could fix anything. The condo that we bought next to Ron had a fireplace in the main room. I'm serious. A 4-foot by 6-foot fireplace that went all the way to the ceiling. And here we bought this condo with these huge windows overlooking the fifth green on a golf course. And we've got a 4-by-6-foot fireplace with chimney right in the middle of the main room that blocked all the windows. Now, I moved to Florida to not need a fireplace. So before we bought it, I asked Ron, how much work will it be for me to take that fireplace out? I've got some construction experience. What do you think? He said, it's not that much. A piece of cake. You can do it in a couple hours. So we closed on the villa, and I immediately went back, got out my tools, and I started dismantling the fireplace. At 5:05, Ron shows up at the door, pulling tools behind him. And he takes over the removal of the fireplace because he knew exactly how it should be done, all the way including the flue in the roof. And I thought, man, what a deal. I'm not offended by you taking over, Ron. You go, Ron. A couple of days later, maybe a couple of weeks, I've got a leaky outside faucet. And I mean, everything in Florida is different. So I thought, maybe they make faucets different in Florida than they do in the Midwest. So I said, Ron, anything I need to know about fixing this outside leaky faucet? You know what Ron did? Went to the garage, got the right tool, came over, and he fixed my faucet for me. I thought, this is super. All I got to do is ask. I just ask how, and he does it. And so the palm tree in our backyard had a bunch of dead branches. I said, Ron, does the lawn service trim the palm trees, or do we need to do that ourselves? You know what he did? He went to his garage. He got his battery-powered tree trimmer with an telescopic handle, and he trimmed my palm trees. He pulled his golf cart over. He loaded up all the dead palm branches, and he hauled them off to the trash. I thought, I am never moving away from Ron. And then on the other side was Deb. The first 6 months we lived there, every time I saw Deb, I would say, hey, how you doing? She never even grunted. She totally ignored me. No eye contact, no facial change of expression, not a single word. You see, each of the condos had a garage that was connected to somebody else's garage with a common driveway. Oh no, my garage couldn't be connected to Ron's. It was connected to Deb's. Which meant every day I would see Deb a couple of times. Always the same response. Hey Deb, how you doing? Go about her business. One day I was going to power wash my half of the driveway. So I went to the door and I knocked and said, hey, Deb, I'm going to power wash my half of the driveway. Be glad to do yours too if you could just move your car off the driveway. She grabbed her keys, she headed to the door, she slammed it, she stomped to her car, she got in, she backed it out to a parking spot, and I power washed her half of the driveway, and she never said a word. She never said thank you. I'm not bitter about it, okay? I'm not bitter. This was 2007, by the way. It was June 14th. 2007, 2:30 in the afternoon. She never said thank you one time. I'm not bitter. I'm just telling you how the story went. Well, in 2008, we began talking to Indiana Ministries about coming back here, and we felt like that's what God wanted us to do. So we put our villa on the market, and 2008 was not a good time to sell anything property-wise in Florida. And so we waited, and we waited. It took about 6-7 months, and we gave it away, almost. But I went back to pack everything up and move it back here, and guess who I bumped into in the driveway? Deb. I said, "Hey, Deb, how you doing?" She said, "Hi, I'm good." And I almost passed out. She halfway smiled. And I thought, this is wild. We lived next door to her for about 2.5 years, and I never get a word. And then I figured it out. We're leaving. We're moving. She knows we're packing up and hauling everything away. And so now she decides to be friendly. And I got the first smile and the first greeting out of her in almost 3 years. Now here's my question for you. Who would you rather have as a neighbor? Ron or Deb? There's going to be a quiz. Those are your two choices. Everyone who would rather have Ron as a neighbor, raise your hand. Come on. Everyone who'd rather have Deb as a neighbor, raise your hand. Yeah. No hands. Now, which of the two do you think God is more like? Ron or Deb? When you pray, do you think God's more like Ron, who just waiting for the opportunity to help and seizes it when you never even ask for help, already starts appropriating the resources to give you a hand when you haven't even verbalized what it is you need yet? Or do you think he's like Deb, who doesn't even want to listen to you, doesn't want to pay any attention to you? And you know he wouldn't help if you were to ask. If today at midnight, some 900 miles from Orlando, I were to call Ron and say, "Ron, I need help," I would expect him to arrive at the door as quick as he could get there. Do you know that's how God is? Doesn't matter what time of day, doesn't matter what the circumstances are, doesn't matter what's happening in the other side of the world that God may be giving attention to. When you have a need and you pray, God's attentive, He's listening, He cares. He begins mobilizing the resources of heaven to respond to your request. I can't explain why there are often long delays and why there are times of apparent inactivity, but when you pray, God is working upstream to generate a response to your prayer. And in time, you'll know what that answer is. A mentor friend of mine told me about a church he worked with for a while, and it was a church that was just bursting at the seams. It was a congregation that was meeting at a school because they had outgrown their church facility. They sold it, and they were in the process of relocating. The church was booming, and it was reaching all kinds of people for Christ. They even had to have 2 services on Sunday morning. Between the 2 services, my friend noticed that there was a woman walking around the empty auditorium at the school, kind of praying over each row of chairs. And so an appropriate time, he walked over and engaged her in conversation. And she said to him, "You know, I've been praying for this church for 20 years. Every Sunday for 20 years, I would walk the aisles and I would anoint each pew and pray for the people who sat in that pew, and I would pray that our church would begin making a dynamic difference in our community and winning people to Christ. And for 20 years, nothing happened." For 20 years, in an auditorium, a sanctuary that sat 400 people, we had less than 200. And then God began moving. God began working. Now it is so exciting to see what God is doing. Wow. Praying for her church for 20 years. And it seemed like God wasn't paying attention. But what a good prayer. Why didn't God answer it in 2 years? Why not 5? Why not 10? Why not 15? I don't know. I don't know how all these spiritual dynamics operate. But what I do know is she didn't quit praying. And at 20 years, the resources of heaven got downstream to where she was. What if she had quit praying? What if she'd gotten irritated at God and said, I'm not going to pray about this anymore? You think about how many lives would not have been changed? And maybe those life changes carried for multiple generations. And if she had quit praying, would God have even acted? What are you praying about? What's happening in your world right now? Have you been through some kind of crisis? Maybe there's some kind of tragedy that's occurred in your life, and you've prayed and you've prayed and you've prayed about it. You're even tired of talking to God about it. And you're still hurting from it deep inside, and yet you're not finding God's comfort. You're not finding God's healing yet, at least not to the degree that you want. Are you going to keep praying? Or are you going to give up? Maybe you've got a parent and somebody close friend in your life, or maybe it's one of your kids. You've been praying for years for them to develop an openness to God working in their lives, and so far it's still just a brick wall. They're no closer to God now than they were when you started praying for them. What do you do? Do you keep praying, or do you quit? Please, keep praying. Are you in a dead-end job? Job you don't really enjoy, or maybe you've lost your job. You've been praying for God to provide you with a job that you just really enjoy. It's fulfilling. It doesn't feel like work. And so far, nothing seems to be happening. You just keep encountering closed door after closed door after closed door. What do? You keep praying? No. Yes. Don't give up. Don't give up. Keep praying. Maybe you're in a marriage and it's got some rough spots. And maybe there's some walls with you and your spouse. And you've talked about some of the same things over and over again. You've made absolutely no progress in resolving the issue or issues. And you find yourself thinking, what do? Do we keep praying? Why? God doesn't seem to be answering. Don't give up. Keep praying. You know, there are things I've been praying about for decades, and I've seen no indication that God is moving upstream whatsoever. But do you know what I've decided? I've decided to keep praying, no matter what, and to believe that God will answer. The only question is really, will I still be praying about it when God acts? I sure hope so. Will you pray with me? Father, there are things that happen in our lives and in our world, and we take them to you in prayer, and you understand. We feel like just nothing's getting through. We feel like maybe we're not praying the right way, or we're not praying for the right things, and yet what we pray about seems just so good and perfect to us. And as we pray over an extended period of time, sometimes we get pretty frustrated with you. Thanks for loving us enough to let us get frustrated. Thanks for loving us enough to even let us get angry with you when you don't answer prayer when and how we think you should. Yet you continue to love us and you continue to work on our behalf. Reaffirm that in our hearts and our lives today. There are things that people in this room are praying about and have been for some time. And God, honestly, they're not seeing any activity from you. But this morning, we're going to increase our resolve not to give up. We're going to keep praying. We're going to keep trusting. And we know that one day, you will break through. Thank you.